Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp. I'm in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. The Fair Housing Act was signed into law by President Lyndon Baines Johnson on this day, 50 years ago in 1968. The law prohibited discrimination in the sale, the rental, and the financing of housing based on race, religion, national origin, or gender. It was later amended to prohibit discrimination based on disability and family status as well. The Fair Housing Act is 50, and yet people of color still face significantly higher barriers when it comes to buying or even repairing a home. The home ownership gap between black and white Americans is now startlingly wider than it was during the Jim Crow era. That's according to an investigative series by Emmanuel Martinez and Aaron Glantz. They work at Reveal News from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Reveal's analysis was independently reviewed by the Associated Press, and that review showed that black applicants for home loans are still rejected at significantly higher rates than whites in the 48 cities that were studied. A discrepancy for Latinos was found in 25 cities. 9 cities found discrepancies in lending for Asians, and in 3 cities for Native Americans. And interestingly enough, in Washington, D.C., of all places, Reveal found that all 4 groups, Latinos, Blacks, Asians, and Native Americans, all 4 groups are significantly more likely to be denied a home loan than whites. So half a century after we assumed that it was outlawed, why does this kind of housing discrimination persist? And is anything being done about it? To take a closer look at this investigation and perhaps tell us what to expect next, we're joined by Emmanuel Martinez. He's a data reporter at Reveal. He co-reported the recent series about disparities in home ownership, and he's joining us from Emeryville, California. Emmanuel, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I listened to this series and it with rapt attention, as I'm sure so many people did who might have been wondering, wow, I thought it was just me. So this series was really fascinating. But let's begin by giving listeners who are new to your work a bit of information about how and you and the reporters on your team were able to discover these discrepancies. You studied the years 2015 and 2016. And you used records that are publicly available under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. And those records include every time an American tried to buy a home with a conventional mortgage in those 2 years. So what made you decide to look at those records? How'd you get your hands on them? And when you did get your hands on them, how did you go about analyzing that data?
Yeah, so my reporting partner, Aaron Glantz, and I started out with the question, you know, it's been 50 years since the Fair Housing Act and 10 years since the housing bust. So we wanted to see what's going on and who was able to get loans or not. So we were able to look at mortgage records from nearly every bank in America, you know, nearly every time someone tries to buy a home. And it's data available under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. So that was millions upon millions of records, nearly 31 million mortgage records, and we were able to hone in on conventional mortgages where the applicant is looking to live in the home that they're looking to buy. And we ended up focusing on conventional loans for several reasons. You know, this was the loan, the gold standard as far as the loan, the one that offers the best deals for applicants, you know, and we wanted to also see how the banks were operating when the government wasn't directly involved. So we spent a year looking at this data set, and we did statistical tests, and we were able to quantify the relationship between race and being denied a mortgage. And as you mentioned at the top, we found in 61 places, 61 different metros, people of color are still more significantly likely to be denied than their white counterparts, even when they make the same amount of money, when they're looking to seek the same amount of loan and live in a similarly situated neighborhood. When you take into account those things, people of color are still more likely to be denied a conventional mortgage than their white counterparts.
Well, anyone who's ever applied for a loan knows that there is an algorithm. And I'm wondering how you controlled for things like income, credit score, the area, neighborhood, zip code, if you will. How are you able to determine that race was such a tremendous factor in your findings?
So without kind of nerding too much here, what I did was we ran a statistical technique called a regression analysis, which allows us to compare applicants of similar income, similar loan amount, and, you know, where they're looking to buy the neighborhood. And all this information is available in the data set that we are looking at, the data provided through the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. It details information about the applicant, their race, their ethnicity, the income, information about the loan, you know, if it's a conventional mortgage, an FHA, and down to the census tract, the neighborhood where the property is located. And what we were also able to do was look at the demographics of that particular neighborhood. So we brought in census data. We looked at, you know, how the black population, the Latino population of that particular area where the property is located. So taking into all those factors, we ran a logistic regression where we're able to hold down those variables constant and then be able to quantify the relationship between the race of the applicant and the denial.
Okay, my eyes just glazed over, but you're right. Well, you know, it really is. It sounds exhaustive. It sounds comprehensive. And it sounds like you factored in so many things. So what shocked you the most about your findings? What about this finding regarding racial disparities in lending really just blew your hair back?
I mean, one of the things that was most shocking was just to see the likelihood or how far the disparity is between people of color and white applicants when looking to buy a loan, even though it's been 50 years since the Fair Housing Act. The other thing that was really startling to me was my reporting partner, Aaron, and I also mapped the number of loans by neighborhood. And that was important because when we were actually in Philadelphia reporting this story, I could actually see where I was on my map in terms of the number of loans. And I could point out, like, neighborhoods that had blight, that were run down, that had that weren't quote unquote family friendly. Those on my map showed up as neighborhoods with few loans, whereas neighborhoods with lots of loans, in terms of lots of people being able to secure a home loan in those neighborhoods, you know, had people walking around, had lots of shops. And so I think that disparity was very real, very visceral, very shocking to me to see how I could place a neighborhood by walking through it on the map that I had created in terms of loans in a particular area.
And part of your surprise was clearly that I'm sure a lot of people thought that we had gotten past all of this. For one thing, it's a federal crime to discriminate, and so based on race and gender and national origin, etc. So a lot of people have been assuming that we are well beyond this. So to what extent did you kind of look into the history of what the law calls for?
Well, there are several laws on the books that are supposed to prevent this, particularly the Fair Housing Act, which says that it is illegal to turn down, to discriminate, right, to not give someone a loan based on race, religion, et cetera. So there's that on the books. The other law is the Community Reinvestment Act, which was supposed to fight the redlining back that was legal back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, up until the 60s. And that says that banks are required to make an effort to lend to all types of communities, and regardless, they're supposed to lend to all communities, you know, and make an effort regardless of who's living there. And that's supposed to combat redlining, which was, you know, where banks were denying loans in neighborhoods with high concentrations of Black and immigrants. So there's also the Community Reinvestment Act, which we also write about.
And so because you had gone into it, I assume, with an assumption that there were measures in place to prevent that, it might be valuable at this point just to talk a little bit about how some of those stopgap measures were supposed to work. You mentioned redlining, and the history of that is that there was literally a red line. There was a practice of using a red pen decades ago around immigrant communities, around Black communities, communities of color, in which those areas couldn't get home loans. So just talk a bit about the history of how people of color had historically been shut out in ways that these laws were designed to overcome.
Yeah, so back in the, as you mentioned, you know, back in the 30s, this was all, redlining was government sponsored. It was legal to discriminate. The government told banks which neighborhoods that they could and should lend to and which ones they could and shouldn't lend to, and neighborhoods with high concentrations of Black and immigrant populations were deemed hazardous, and as you mentioned, it was a red designation that they were hazardous and that they should stay away. And one of the things that was one of the laws specifically meant to combat that was the Community Reinvestment Act, which required banks to lend to all types of communities. But one of the problems, one of the loopholes that we found was that it's race neutral. So a bank could lend to a blighted, quote unquote, blighted neighborhood, but it could make those loans to white applicants and not the people who actually live there who wouldn't actually need it the most.
And you write that actually the gap between homeownerships among white families and African Americans had actually, perhaps because of some of the measures that were put in place, had actually begun to shrink starting in the 1970s and actually began to explode after that time. But something happened where all of a sudden this practice of not lending to people of color and redlining communities happened again. What is the arc of that?
Well, you have to kind of look at like the history of, you know, people of color and their relationship with lending institutions and building wealth, right? In the 30s, as you know, we've been talking about, it was redlining that they were shut out. That they could not get loans. And then, you know, 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, we were seeing the opposite, that people of color were getting predatory loans, that they were getting loans that they should have never gotten with balloon payments, with higher interest rates. And so when you look at specifically in terms of building wealth, home ownership is one of the best ways to do that, you know. If you own your home, that makes you a little richer in terms of, you know, redlining, and that door was automatically closed for people of color. That means that they inherently could not build wealth as fast and as quick as their white counterparts.
And that was part of the Reveal investigation, too. It showed just how much home ownership matters in wealth building and in social mobility. And you write that the median net worth for an African-American family is about $9,000. Latino families, median net worth about $12,000. That's compared to the median net worth of a white family, which is $132,000. How does home ownership give families of color a leg up?
Well, I mean, any family owning a home gives them a leg up, right? If you and I make the same amount of money, but I'm renting and you own your home, you know, you are automatically have more wealth than I do because you can pull out money from it. You're building equity. You know, you're improving your credit score by owning that home and making payments on it. And it's easier to buy a second home when you already own one, whereas someone who doesn't own their home, it's an upward battle, and you don't have anything. You can't pull out a loan, you can't pull out a second mortgage to pay for your children's colleges, where that's much easier if you've already owned a home and you can pull equity out of it.
So that's what, just one of the things that a family that owns a home can do that one that doesn't own a home cannot. Are there other things that create intergenerational wealth, that home ownership literally creates the possibility of wealth building?
Well, you can also pass that home down to your children, right? And then they've become the sole owners of it. And again, like when you own one home, it's a lot easier to, you know, buy a second one or, you know, pull equity out of it. And it's much easier for someone to pass a home down to their children than it is to actually buy one. So it just makes that intergenerational wealth much easier if you can just pass your home on to one of your children.
And it's certainly the American dream. Everyone, you know, wants to probably own a little piece of the rock, as it were. But it's unlikely that any bank would ever just flat out say they discriminate against African Americans or Latinos seeking home loans. In fact, one bank that you talked to told you that because of a lack of federal enforcement, it's a testament to just how little discrimination there is. So talk about federal oversight and the extent to which banks are getting away with redlining and failing to lend because they're not being overseen.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things I mentioned earlier was the Community Reinvestment Act, and which requires banks to make an effort and lend to qualified borrowers in all types of communities, in any way you define it. But one of the holes in that loop, in that law, is that it's race neutral. So you could be lending in a neighborhood that is, you know, quote unquote blighted, that's not as wealthy, and banks are getting credit for that, but they could be lending to white applicants, which spurs gentrification and leaving out people of color. So that's one way that banks get credit for, you know, lending to all types of community, even though they're not specifically lending to people of color. Now what we found with this current administration is that they haven't sued any single bank for discrimination. The previous administration had. This current administration had loosened up the rules in which banks are reviewed. But we found that, you know, before the Trump administration came to be, banks were still passing their Community Reinvestment Act at 99% of the time. There are very few banks that were downgraded. And now it's kind of, we're seeing a loosening of the rules, so to speak.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Emmanuel Martinez, and we're talking about racial disparities in home ownership and how it mimics some pretty old patterns of redlining and racial discrimination. Have you applied for a home loan lately and suspected that if you were denied, that race was a factor? Are you a lending officer? What factors into your decision to make a home loan? 866-798-8255 is the number. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on today's Your Call. Emmanuel, I listened again to the entire series, and you looked at Philadelphia, but as a case study. But as I listened, because California is one of those places where it's so difficult for people to buy a home, and because real estate is so expensive, I just wondered how many of the anecdotes that you talked about are mimicked over and over again every day here in California. One applicant was a black woman in Philadelphia. She worked at a university. Her income was around $60,000 a year, and she was denied loans over and over again. And at one point, they just stopped even returning her calls. And then her white life partner, who was working in a grocery store, earning much, much less, agreed to sign on, and suddenly, eureka, she got the loan. Is that uncommon? How common was it?
So all the people of color that, you know, we had talked to always expressed the same sentiment that, you know, there was always someone was always fishing for a reason to say no. And for the woman that we write about, you know, it was that she didn't have a full-time job, that she was a contractor. Well, she got a job, you know, making $60,000 a year working at the University of Pennsylvania. Then it was that, you know, this unpaid electric bill surfaced up on her credit report, and that seemed to be the reason that, you know, she couldn't go forward with the application. Whereas, you know, as you mentioned, her partner, who was making $144 a week working part-time at a grocery store, when she came on to the application process, that was what put her over the top. So, and that was kind of what we had heard from a lot of the people that we spoke to, that, you know, people were always looking for a reason to say no to them. And in California, you know, to answer your question regarding California, we found in three places, Vallejo, Chico, and Salinas, where black or Latino applicants were more likely to be denied. But that's not to say that this problem doesn't exist anywhere else in California. One of the things, you know, we had to develop one statistical model and apply it to several places in the nation. And those cities, those metros often differ in terms, are very diverse in terms of population, in terms of median income, in terms of housing stock. So one of the reasons other places in California did not show up was because we needed to create a more well-tailored statistical model for those metros. So just because it doesn't show up in our analysis doesn't mean that this isn't a problem in any other city, that it may take other forms. There may be other forms of discrimination happening.
Well, for credit reporting, that is the major determinant, is my understanding, in most lending decisions. And unless you check that box on the application where you identify your race, I don't even understand how an institution, a lending institution, would know how to discriminate. So why do you still see disparities, given that without that kind of identifier on the application, why is credit, let's talk about credit as a determinant again.
So, credit score is, you know, that's what lending institutions use as one of the main reasons to, you know, approve or deny someone a loan. And when we spoke to lending institutions, they say that, you know, this explains why people of color are denied at far greater rates than their white counterparts because of credit score. Because oftentimes people of color have lower credit score. But then you have to look at, you know, how credits, the formula of credit score, how it works and how it doesn't work. And I've always seen credit score and owning a home as a chicken and an egg relationship, where you need a good credit score to own a home, but owning a home helps you improve said credit score. Mm. And the reason why I say that is when you take into account how a credit score is calculated and how to boost up a credit score, having a mortgage, having a credit card, you know, the types of credit that people of color are often shut out of, those are the ways that one can improve most quickly their credit score. And because both on-time payments and negative payments are both reflected on your credit score. So if you have some type of medical emergency or a funeral or some other thing come up and you miss your mortgage payment, that shows up on your credit score. But then you have the other, let's say, 99 on-time mortgage payments also reflected on your credit report. So it's a give and take.
But those kinds of things are colorblind. I mean, those things happen to people of all races. So why it doesn't really explain the disparity in lenders' decisions, right?
But then if – so people of color, you know, what we've found is that people of color are more shut out – are often more shut out of the mortgage market, and that, you know, there's been studies that show that people of color often operate in, you know, in rent – in payday loans. And the reason why that's important to take into account is, again, those types of credit, like when you pay rent, only often reflect when you miss a payment, not when you're making them. So I could be making my rent on time for 5 years, and, you know, the next month I have something come up and I miss my rent. That's the only payment that's reflected on my credit score. Same thing with payday loans. So when you take into credits, like how the credit score is, you know, calculated, it often disproportionately affects people of color because they're operating in rent, in utility bills, in payday loans, which doesn't often reflect, you know, the on-time payments, and they can't build their credit score that way.
We're talking today about racial disparities in home ownership, and we're talking with news reporter Emmanuel Martinez. We hope you'll join us. Do you make loans? Have you attempted to get a loan and were denied? We'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call. We'll be back right after a short break. For those of you just joining us, welcome back. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call. Today, we are talking about racial disparities in home ownership 50 years after the signing of the Fair Housing Act, and we'd love to hear from you. If you're a homeowner, did you experience race-based discrimination in your path to buying that home, and what did that look like? Do you know if you live in a community that has been redlined? And if you are a lender, what goes into your decisions? 866-798-8255 is the number. Let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Jeffrey in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hey, Renee. This is Jeffrey from Nashville, Tennessee, and from Birmingham, Alabama, and from the Bay Area in Oakland, California. I've lived in both cities. And so I want to talk to you about what I have know about as a 36-year-old career banker. I've lent money to people buying mortgages. I've lent money to people for credit cards. I've done it all. So let's talk about the credit issue, because I think that's near and dear to my heart. The credit issue is a behavioral model, and it's based on individuals' buying behaviors. So if you have a tendency to go out and shop at high-end credit scores, that's going to negatively affect your score. It also is a behavioral model that says if you tend to pay a bill other than paying your mortgage, which is a very roof over your head, but yet you choose to be on time with your credit card payment, but yet you choose not to be on time with your mortgage payment, that's an indication that you're willing to jeopardize the very roof over your head instead of paying your mortgage first as opposed to paying the credit card second. Second thing, when it comes about income, you can make $50,000 a year and have an 800 credit score. I've seen people at the wealthiest point make $500,000 a year and have 500 credit score. Once again, it's about how well you're informed about your credit and how you manage your credit. It has nothing to do with income. And the last thing about disparities in lending. I've seen it. I do know that lending in certain areas tends to be a little more difficult, which can be based on values of homes. If you live in an area where their annual income or the income per capita, it might be $150,000 a year, and that's a more stable income area in that community. But if you're borrowing money for an area where the income level might be about $30,000 or $40,000 a year, then you're going to see housing prices vary a whole lot. So I'm not going to stay on the phone and talk about that in great detail, but I wanted to share that with your listening audience. And that doesn't matter. Those principles don't matter if you live in the Bay Area. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you live in Kansas. It doesn't matter if you live in Birmingham. It doesn't matter if you live in Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you very much for this opportunity, and I look forward to getting feedback from your audience. Have
Thank
a great
you.
Day.
Thanks. It's good to hear from a banker. Emmanuel Martinez, reveal, what did your investigation show in terms of people who make bad credit decisions, not getting home ownership loans, and then controlling for the racial aspect of those lending decisions?
Well, to go back, what we had talked about before, when we looked at, we looked at every metro, 409 to be exact, metros across the country. And when we, controlled for income, the loan amount, the ratio between the two, and neighborhood characteristics, the populations, the demographics of particular neighborhoods, when we hold all those variables constant, people of color are more likely to be turned away. So, if you have a black applicant and a white applicant who make the same amount of money, who are requesting a similar sized loan and wanting to live in a similar sized neighborhood, the applicant of color is more likely to be turned away.
For those of us who are not familiar with banking, tell us about the importance of branch offices. We just heard from Jeffrey in Nashville, and I didn't realize the connection between the availability of branch offices in your community and the availability of loans.
Well, yeah. So in Philadelphia, we also decided to look at the location of bank branches. And we found that, nearly three quarters of all branches in the Philadelphia metro were located primarily in white neighborhoods. And one bank, TD Bank, had none in majority black neighborhoods. And so, that begs the question, right? When we talk about discrimination, oftentimes it plays in terms of resources, and do neighborhoods of color have the same amount of access when it comes to branches, and physically being able to walk into a branch and ask for a loan and information regarding the loan as someone who lives in a white neighborhood.
All right, let's go to the phones again. Lisa in San Francisco, thanks for waiting. You have a question?
Yes, I do. Actually, I have a comment. And it was due out of my experience that I went to New Orleans after Katrina. 4 months after Katrina, I was there to volunteer, and I noticed there was, what happened in Katrina is that it was the majority of the people who lost their homes there in New Orleans in the Ninth Ward happened to be black people. And they lost their homes because the insurance companies would not pay them even the cost of the gutting, even the cost to be able to gut their houses. So, and the fact that they had been sent to different parts of the country and had difficulty getting back in time, some of them lost their homes because they were bulldozed right underneath their noses without even having to be able to go back to be able to deal with that. But also the other thing calls to mind that it's kind of, even though the act mentioned by your guest is really important, Martin Luther King Jr. mentioned in an interview very clearly that after 1872, it seems like the U.S. government decided that it would be worthwhile to give land grants to European immigrants, white European immigrants, whereas it left most the former slaves without anything. And that bill, that basically has created repercussions to this day, because the disparity is basically came from that era and continues to this day. And one law such as the one that your guest is mentioning would not have been enough to be able to deal with that major disparity in income and assets and everything like that.
All right. Thank you, Lisa. Emmanuel, you really did look into the history of failure to failure to enforce the existing laws. I was reading up on what happened when President Nixon decided to kind of derail the whole idea of open communities, a plan that then Housing and Urban Development Chief George Romney, Mitt Romney's father, had decided to enact. He had ordered HUD officials to reject any applications for water or sewer or highway projects from any city where local policies fostered redlining or segregated housing. But Richard Nixon personally shut that down, wrote on a note, shut this down, stop this one. And he went on to explain that he's convinced that while legal segregation is, quote, totally wrong, that forced integration of housing is just as wrong. How many attitudes like that did you run up against in your reporting?
Well, that wasn't something that, you know, we came across in terms of our reporting. Most of it was focused on, you know, buying a home and not you know, forced integration. Although there's a, I will say, you know, that the research that we did and the reporting that we did, you know, shows that they go hand in hand in terms of where people of color can buy a home and segregation. You know, the previous studies have shown that. But, you know, I will say that, you know, in Philadelphia, and I was even looking at, been looking at maps in Fresno County, you know, you do still see segregation in terms of, you know, a large concentration of, you know, the black population living in one pocket and the white population totally living on the other side. And again, in Fresno, the Latino population living on one side of the 99 freeway and the white population living on the opposite. And you do see a pattern in terms of loans, in loans that are secured and loans, you know, in homes that are bought, that often the large concentration of loans are bought in white neighborhoods. And I've seen that pattern in Memphis and Chicago and Fresno and in Philadelphia. And on the off chance that there is one neighborhood of color that is getting a large number of loans, oftentimes it's going to white applicants.
And what happens to neighborhoods when it's hard for homeowners to get improvement loans? You looked in your series at a Philadelphia neighborhood called Nicetown, and it was redlined in the 1930s. Banks made some 67 home improvement loans there, but they denied 315. So what happens when there's a lack of investment?
So, you know, when in Nicetown, you know, that was one of the places where, you know, I saw it so stark in terms of, you know, on my map and the lack of loans that that neighborhood was getting and in terms of, you know, what it looks like. There were boarded up homes, abandoned homes. So it just wasn't an appealing neighborhood, so to speak. And the neighborhoods, the residents there were, you know, trying really hard and, you know, to keep up their neighborhood and, you know, had developed this group where, you know, they were going to try to their best to, you know, maintain the neighborhood and not let it deteriorate. So there's, you know, we've seen a pattern there where, you know, neighborhoods that were getting a lot of investment were often the most that were, you know, most appealing to people to live in, whereas, you know, neighborhoods that were not getting a lot of investment from banks were often struggled to, you know, maintain the appeal or the upkeep.
It may be worth bringing up an article that just came out from the East Bay Times, and it was pretty startling. It showed, for example, in the East Bay, black home buyers could only afford to buy 5% of the homes on the market. 5%. For Hispanics, home buyers, they could afford to buy approximately 22% of the homes on the market. Asian potential home buyers could afford to buy 48%, and white potential home buyers could afford 53%. What occurs to you when you hear numbers like that, Manuel?
As you were reading those, I just think about like the generational the generational wealth, the history of redlining, also the, you know, and how much that plays into, you know, the reporting that Aaron and I have done in terms of looking at loans and the likelihood of, you know, being shut out of a mortgage because of race or ethnicity, and how much that contributes to the numbers that, you know, you just mentioned and read online.
Today we're talking about racial disparities in home ownership, and the number is 866-798-8255. Let's go to Nicholas in Oakland. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi. Great program. I had a question today about what you're talking about here, which is your earlier host, Jeffrey, said, or guest, Jeffrey, said that essentially, most of the decisions about who gets a mortgage is based on credit score, and he was making the case that it was a valid and a race-blind metric. And so my thought was, if it is a valid race-blind metric and we try to close the gap on people getting mortgages based on race, then that could lead to a higher rate of foreclosure in the Black and Latino communities. Did you do any research about what the foreclosure rates were compared to white communities in the Black and Latino communities? And do you think that the possibility to grow wealth through home ownership would be worth the risk of an increased rate of foreclosure if that did happen?
Thanks, Nicholas. Emmanuel Martinez, what did you find?
Yeah, so on this one, we only were looked at data regarding the, you know, getting a loan and being denied one, and, you know, being able to quantify the relationship between being denied and the race of ethnicity of a prospective borrower. And, you know, to the credit score point, you know, there are many studies that show that, you know, people of color have lower credit scores, and not because they're bad borrowers, but because, as I mentioned earlier, how credit score is calculated. And in Philadelphia, we've seen what we also saw, that it was more expensive to rent than it was to pay a mortgage. So people were paying more on their rent than they were on a mortgage. So what that means is that, you know, if you could definitely pay your rent and it's more expensive, then you could probably pay your mortgage, which would be cheaper.
Let's go to Eric in San Francisco. Thanks, Eric.
Hi, how are you today?
Great.
I just want to say that, you know, I know you're talking about the current day situation, but I just wanted to just put my two cents in from a more historical perspective. I live out here now, and I grew up outside of Boston. And in 1957, when my parents moved to the suburbs about 20 miles out, people started passing around a petition so they couldn't move in. I myself am Asian American, specifically Chinese American. And it didn't work out. We ended up living in the town. And all I wanted to say is I really feel badly for folk who have been denied loans for housing due to race. And it really stays with you for your whole life. It really, you know, you try to let bygones be bygones and you move on. But that kind of thing really impacts your life, and it's very sad.
Eric, are you surprised at the extent to which this sort of thing is still going on?
No, I'm not. I used to work in EEO and affirmative action.
Mm.
And, you know, I've seen a lot. I've heard a lot. You hear rumors. You see things that happen. I'm not surprised, especially now with what it's like in national politics.
We're going to talk about that a bit, too, this issue in the Trump era. But before we do that, let's go to Nancy in Richmond. Nancy, you have a question?
Yeah, I guess this may have been addressed already, but I didn't tune in until just a little while ago. I'm just curious about what the differential between getting loans and not getting loans if you're applying as an interracial couple. My husband is Black, and we just refinanced, and As far as I know, we didn't encounter any difficulty getting the loan, but I was just curious about what kind of impact that has on obtaining a loan.
Thank you, Nancy. Thanks for the question. Emmanuel Martinez?
That's a very good question. And for this particular study, we were only focusing on the primary race of the primary applicant. So we only took into account that. And this was based on conversations with several, you know, leading academics and people from, you know, the techniques used by the Justice Department and the Federal Reserve. But that is something worth looking into, I think, for future studies, future reports. I will add, though, that, you know, we had our story and our data and our analysis disseminated through the Associated Press, and one of the newspapers in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, they reported on a story about a mixed race couple who qualified for the loan, but the lender told them that they had to find a different neighborhood.
Wow.
So we have anecdotes of mixed race couples being denied or being told to look elsewhere. But again, that also depends on the area. But that, again, that's just something worth looking into that could provide a different complexity and a nuanced angle to this analysis.
So grateful to Nancy for just expressing her concerns around just how much of a problem this is and how it may still persist. And Eric, talking about the pain that persists after you find that you've been the victim of this. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, originally, and we saw it too. A friend of ours moved into an all-white neighborhood in Shaker Heights, but it was because her mother was so fair-skinned as an African-American that she was able to pass for white, and she was able to get the loan. Even at a time when women weren't able to get the loan, she was able to get the loan, and then she brought her husband and children in and shocked the whole community at the time. Her husband, by the way, was a principal at a high school, very well qualified to have a loan, but it had to be done clandestinely in order to get in. So, and it sticks with you, that feeling, as Eric shared, sticks with you. So, Emmanuel, let's talk about the Trump era and the extent to which the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau under Mick Mulvaney has actually stripped some of the fair lending enforcement teeth out of the law.
Yeah, so we were looking, specifically in our stories, we were also looking at the Community Reinvestment Act, which I mentioned earlier, you know, which requires banks to lend to all types of communities and neighborhoods. And just last week, they released their report in terms of how they would update the law, because many people felt it was outdated. And what, you know, by talking to experts and people who work in this area, we kind of received the feeling that it was a mixed bag, that it would help in some ways, but not necessarily in others. One of the ways that it would help was, you know, it would bring in economists. It would require, you know, the help of economists and experts who would be able to show, you know, are you gentrifying the neighborhood based on your lending patterns? So that's one way we felt that you know, it could improve the Community Reinvestment Act. And some of the other ways that, you know, had no effect or might potentially make things a little worse were the fact that it still remains race neutral. So, you know, and that's not going to help with the likelihood or race-based denials that, you know, people of color are more likely to be denied a mortgage. It wouldn't help with that. One of the other ways that we also found that was concerning was a lot of people that we spoke to found that there was this deprioritization of bank branches, that because, you know, there's more emphasis on internet and online banking, that, you know, the Community Reinvestment Act should move away from, you know, bank branches and physical bank branches. But, you know, previous studies have shown that Oftentimes, you know, after the recession hit, many banks closed down several branches, and those that were most affected were, you know, poor working class communities and communities of color. And that goes to, you know, do people even have access to walk into a bank branch, you know, ask questions about the loan, get this financial literacy from a bank? So we felt that it, we found that it wasn't, this updating of the CRA wasn't going to help in those, in that particular way either.
Emmanuel, in our final couple of minutes, Reveal produced an interactive map, and it shows where people of color are more likely to be denied a home loan than whites, and listeners can find that at yourcallradio.org. But what other tools do listeners have to educate themselves about modern-day redlining that might be happening near them with just about 2 minutes to go?
Yeah, so you mentioned that map. That is one way to get that information, you know, where it shows neighborhoods, but it also shows which banks are, you know, have large volumes of loans going to people of color in a particular neighborhood. You can look up San Francisco or Oakland or down in San Jose, you know, and find which banks are actually lending to people of color and which neighborhoods, you know, are getting large loans, are people of color getting loans in.
Emmanuel Martinez, a data reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, thank you so much for the hard work that you put in and the revelations that you came up with in that reporting. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our listeners. To listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Wenis produced today's show. Joshua Wilner is the social media producer. Phil Hartman is chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I thank you for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call.